You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, March 21st, 2013. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Brooks.
And this is The Majority Report. We are broadcasting live from the literal, but not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building.
In the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. We have a great show for you today, folks. Filling in for Sam again as he completes the life cycle. Last week of birth. This week, sadly, passing away. Sam's in Massachusetts for the funeral of his grandmother, who lived till 100 years old. So she did have a good
life.
It's
a celebration of life.
Celebration.
That's what you said. I agree. That's what it sounds like to me.
The full cycle here, folks. We have a great show for you today, hopefully.
Oh, we definitely
obviously do. This is a precipitous drop in quality.
That's what Sam said yesterday.
That's what Sam said.
Well, today we have for you, we're interviewing Tor Eklund. He's the attorney for Andrew Weave Onheimer and Matthew Keyes. Both have been charged in different parts of their cases now. Different quote-unquote hacking cases. We'll be discussing that with him.
It's a really unbelievable story, folks. Very relevant to the Majority Report universe and open information, a lot of stuff that we really care about. Matt's going to come over in a second, switch up, lead that interview. Also, President Obama's in the Middle East. But is there really any more credibility for us there in that situation? Probably not. Singapore, through the type of government intervention that even someone like me might not feel comfortable with, has accomplished some good things fighting inequality. That's a goading for libertarians who are welcome to call. We will still beat you precipitously, even as the quality of the show drops precipitously, if you call on the better half. And Rush Limbaugh, well, he has some really interesting insight on something that you would not expect him to have interesting insight about. We'll get that to that in the better half of the show as well. But you know what, folks? We're going to switch off right now and get to that great interview with Tor Eklund, which Matt is going to lead on. Stick with us, and we'll have a great show for you. Thanks.
No.
We are back. My name is Matt Binder, filling in for Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. And on the phone now, we have Tor Eklund, who is a Brooklyn-based lawyer representing both Andrew Weave Orenheimer and Matthew Keys. Thank you for joining us, Tor.
A pleasure to be here.
Great. So, Tor, let's get started right here with Andrew, who goes by Andrew Orenheimer's case. He goes by Weave online, I believe. Yes, Weave. And
yeah, that's correct.
Okay, great. Let's start with just what exactly is he being? Was he alleged of doing? And what were DOJ prosecutors charging him with?
Essentially, he was charged with conspiracy to commit unauthorized access to a protected computer, and another count of federal identity theft. And essentially what happened is his co-defendant, Daniel Spittler, who pleaded guilty and, you know, took a plea deal with the government. Daniel Spittler, in I think roughly May of 2010, right when the iPad came out, discovered that if you queried AT&T's iPad email servers with what was essentially a customer ID number, you know, it was a SIM card number, you know, printed right on the SIM card. If you queried AT&T's servers with that number and it actually matched a SIM card number of an actual customer, AT&T's iPad servers would publish a login window. And in that login window would be that customer's address. And then there would be a password prompt where you could enter the password. So Spittler ended up writing a script that basically just counted off numbers, you know, like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Mm-hmm. And if he hit the servers with a number that wasn't a customer number, nothing happened. They didn't get kicked off. They didn't get asked for a password or anything. But if they hit an actual, you know, customer number, then that customer's email address was published, and they essentially compiled Spittler compiled a list of about roughly 114,000 email addresses. And then Andrew Weave took that list and sent it to Gawker after Gawker agreed to, you know, print it in redacted form. He also sent some emails to some members of the media that he found on the list saying, hey, you know, we just discovered this, you know, thing that AT&T's iPad email servers are doing. And about a week later, the FBI kicked in his door, guns drawn in Arkansas, and arrested him. And we went to trial. There was a guilty verdict on November 20th, 2012, and he's now been sentenced to 41 months in prison and $73,000 in restitution.
How? $73,000?
Well, yeah, that's based on the fact that AT&T sent out a direct mailing to inform all its customers, even though it sent emails to them like a week earlier. And so it's like basically they're trying to stick him with the cost of the AT&T's direct mailing to its customers.
So basically, I just want to sort of drive this point home that what you're saying is that what they did basically, Weave and his and Daniel Spittler. Basically, what they did was this was all publicly accessible information. There was no breaking of any sort of security system at AT&T or anything of that sort. Correct?
That is absolutely correct. And as a matter of fact, it came out at trial that AT&T had made a conscious business decision to have things set up this way. You know, they knew they could have password protected the email addresses, but they decided for customer convenience that they weren't going to do it.
Jeez.
And so essentially, you know, all that's happening here is you've got numbers being entered into a URL, and it's querying a publicly accessible server that AT&T admitted at trial is available to anybody with an internet connection, and bang, now you've got a felony. And I think the implications of that are scary, you know, for a lot of computer users, because I think if this interpretation of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act is correct, well, then potentially thousands of Americans are committing a computer felony every day.
Did either Weave or Daniel Spittler, did either of them contact AT&T beforehand, additionally, did they release the emails, the list of emails, to the public, or just to the different like I believe it was Gawker who wrote the original story that they originally gave the information to?
It's my understanding that they didn't contact AT&T. AT&T found out about it from one of its subscribers that we've emailed. And remember, it was email addresses. There was no, like, emails downloaded, no, like, private information. This is purely about email addresses, and then the list that Andrew supposedly transferred to Gawker was actually never produced at trial. I think all the lists got destroyed, and the only person who got the list was Gawker. And I think the theory behind not going to AT&T with these guys was that essentially that, you know, if you go to these corporations and point these things out, they quite often just bury it and you don't get a fix right away.
Yes.
Whereas AT&T, as soon as they got all this press, had, you know, fixed it really, really fast.
Of course. After that. Yeah. Did AT&T say that, did they say that there was any sort of a loss on their end? Any sort of, I mean, did AT&T want to pursue this?
You know, AT&T, I don't think, is behind this prosecution. There's an email that came out at, you know, trial that we put into evidence where, you know, early on the FBI is contacting AT&T, and AT&T's lead, or one of their lead investigators in this matter, just says, you know, I don't see a case here. I don't think a crime was committed. You know, you've got a poorly, you know, designed, you know, system. I don't see it. I think what is behind this prosecution is really that, you know, the DOJ really wanted to take Andrew out, and, you know, they did. I don't think AT&T really was, you know, an aggressive force behind this prosecution.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it just seems like they wouldn't want to get any additional press to it. So, yeah, I completely could see that. I just want to jump to this past, I believe it was Monday, the 18th. That's when he was sentenced to the 41 months in prison and ordered to pay the $73,000 in restitution. I was reading some of the details that prosecutors were trying to – some of the details in terms of which the prosecutors were trying to portray Weave. Could you go into some detail about that? I thought that was just unbelievably interesting.
Well, you know, at sentencing, you're allowed to talk about, you know, the character of the defendant and whatnot. So they just pretty much, I mean, Weave's an infamous internet troll, and they pretty much went to town on that point. They, you know, were pulling out emails where, you know, that made him look bad, even though it's like you couldn't really, I couldn't tell what the context of the email was, because they just like pulled it out of his, you know, Gmail account. And they just basically tried to make him, you know, look like the horrible person who's, you know, out to wreck everyone's lives and make tons of money on the internet. You know, that kind of hyperbole that quite often a lot of these people in these computer circles talk with, you know, kind of got pulled out of context a little bit, I think, in the courtroom, and just used to, you know, portray him as this horrible threat to the Republic that needs to be locked up for everyone's safety, basically.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I was just reading through it, and they used his – he did a IAMA on Reddit the night before just to talk about his trial, and they used that against him because he talked about his regrets of what he did and how he would have done it if he could go back. I mean, just unbelievable stuff.
Yeah, they monitored him pretty intensely. I hadn't even watched that Reddit feed when they were introducing that in court. But I think he also knew that. You know, in a certain sense, you know, he was a troll to the end there.
Yeah.
And you know, he kept trolling, and you know, he's an interesting individual,
say the least. Yes. One more thing I want to touch upon that. I don't have to spend too much time on this, but I read that they explained the term script kiddie to try to frame him as a hacker. And to me, that's hilarious because knowing a bit about the hacking community, the term script kiddie is usually used as a derogatory term in the hacking community because it's not really hacking. And on top of that, what a script kiddie basically is, I guess, for our listeners, is like it's someone who like uses a program to basically, you know, just that they didn't even create usually to try to just figure out information, not even breaking into the system. Like, for example, they use a program to just guess random keywords to try to find out what your password is. It's just complete guesswork. And the fact that he didn't even have to guess any passwords, anything like that. The scripting that they used was simply to quickly gain this publicly accessible information. And it's just unbelievable to me that they even brought this term up, script kiddie, as they're trying to call him a hacker when this is such a – it's not a hacker at all.
Yeah, I think there's a big disconnect, in the understanding there on the DOJ's part about what's going on in the computer world, in the hacker culture. And, you know, I mean, they're trying to – win a case, so they're trying to portray him as some sort of super sophisticated hacker, and I think the irony, as you're pointing out, is that really it wasn't any kind of super sophisticated. It wasn't even hacking.
Yes.
I mean, this wasn't a hack, you know, because a hack, I think, really just it implies that you're, you know, trying to bypass a password or you're changing code or something. This wasn't even that. This was just a public query to a publicly accessible server.
So where we go from here with this case? What is the next step for Weave?
We're filing our notice of appeal today, and we've got a great appellate team, Oren Kerr, who's I consider to be like the top computer law scholar in the country. He writes for Law Conspiracy. He literally wrote the computer law casebook. He's working on the appeal for free pro bono, and actually I think we will be posting something on the Law Conspiracy later this afternoon, you know, about sort of why he decided to take the case and the issues that he thinks are important. We've also hooked up with the Electronic Frontier Foundation in San Francisco. We got Marsha Hoffman and Hemi Fakhouri over there, so we've got a really good appellate team, and we're gonna you know, appeal this you know, all the way up the ladder if we have to.
Great. EFF, yeah, they're a great organization. Before we jump to the Matthew Keyes case, I want to quickly just touch upon. I was reading through the I guess you can call it where was this? The hearing ruling that came out, and the sentencing ruling that came out. I'm sorry. I read that. I was reading through it, and one thing that struck me as very interesting was how you argued how in another case that's currently ongoing, Jeremy Hammond's case. Jeremy Hammond is the individual who is being accused of the Stratfor leaks, and the judge of that case, Judge Loretta Preska, she was asked to remove herself from the case because her husband's email address and those of his clients were part of the Stratfor leak. Their email addresses were part of the leak. She said that she would not be removing herself from the case because the emails were publicly available information and they did not injure her husband. So I mean, and then you argued that if she has this if the court has this this outlook on these emails, how can they not have the same outlook on these emails in determining Weave's offense level?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Again, email addresses, because it wasn't emails. I mean, I catch myself saying emails too, but I think it's important to know that it's email addresses. You know, it's not even I do it too. People do it naturally, but there was like no substantive content that they got or anyone's communications. Purely their email address, which I consider to be just like a street address. I mean, these are things that you use to communicate publicly all the time. You're sending them all over the place, and I thought, you know, Preska, you know, had a point there. It's like email addresses aren't a big deal. You know, so yeah, I mean, that's why we saw that in Hammond's case, and we decided to, you know, argue that for sentencing.
It's just amazing. It's just amazing how hypocritical that is, you know. I guess let's jump.
Yeah, you got it.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, continue.
I mean, I think one of the things is like with this, particularly with the second count in Andrew's case, the identity theft statute 18 U.S.C. 1028A7. It has such a broad definition of what's a means of identification. It basically forbids the possession or transfer of a means of identification in furtherance of another crime. And in Andrew's case, the crime that this was in furtherance was count one, the unauthorized access. But it's sort of like, again, there's no real harm here yet. You've got these felony penalties because of this, and I think the computer statutes here are a little draconian in their penalties when there really isn't any real, you know, harm.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So let's jump to Matthew Keyes. This was also just in the news. Just happened. He received the indictment. I believe it was last Thursday or Friday. Thursday, I believe it was.
Yeah, Thursday.
A lot of people know him as the Reuters social media editor. He's goes by Producer Matthew or the Matthew Keyes on Twitter. Basically, give us what they're alleging him of doing and what charges he's received.
He's being charged again under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, you know, 18 U.S.C. 1030, but a different section of it. And it's not, I think it's a three-count indictment. What he's being charged for is the transmission of information essentially to damage a protected computer. And under the CFAA, anything with a microchip is a protected computer. Basically, you know, the definition of protected computer is just, you know, this phone I'm talking on is a protected computer. And they're alleging that what he did essentially is, after he was fired, allegedly fired from his job, I believe in like Sacramento for, I think, a Tribune company. They're saying about 2 months later, he was in a IRC room, Internet Feds, which are very notorious IRC room, and that he passed a username and password from the Tribune to somebody in that room, and that they eventually were able to sort of deface this article that was appearing on the LA Times website. And it's like a one-page, very short article on tax cuts where somebody just changed some of the words, like the names from, you know, whatever, Bob Smith to Chippy 1234. I mean, it's not even clear to me that that's damage. Exactly. Under the statute, but now he's been hit. He's facing a maximum, I think, of 25 years in jail and $750,000 in fines. You know, again, you know, they like to say, the DOJ and everyone likes to say, oh, well, you won't, you know, like with Swartz, they said, oh, you wouldn't have gotten that sentence. You know, but these are still felony counts. You know, you're still in the press as a, you know, someone who's been indicted as a felon. So, you know, what would he get if he was convicted? I don't know, maybe 1 to 3, but still, you know. And he maintains his innocence, and I you know, I believe him. You know, we're going to vigorously litigate that one.
The interesting thing about what he could possibly face is that I was reading online that, for example, let's say somebody did do this, and they received the same charges that Matthew is receiving. They would have received less charges, less fines, less prison time, if they just walked in and as a way to show their old company off, he just assaulted his boss. He would have received less time.
Yeah, that's a good point. I saw that. There was an Atlantic blog pointed that out, and Hani Fakuri over at EFF pointed it out, is that, you know, he would have faced a lot less penalties if he'd just gone to the, you know, front of the LA Times building and defaced it with spray paint, because it probably would have been a misdemeanor under California law, at worst a felony where you get, you know, a couple of years and a few $1,000 in fines. And yeah, so there's this weird sort of disconnect. You know, a lot of people have been pointing, like the Steubenville rapist, only get, you know, getting 2 years. There's this weird disconnect to having these really hardcore felony penalties in these computer laws that don't jive with our normal, you know, physical world notions of, you know, punishment for serious crimes. Like, I mean, these punishments on these computer law statutes are on par with like aggravated assault and rape and, you know, manslaughter and whatnot. And, you know, I think we need to take a step back to see if that's really warranted in you know, the majority of situations. Sure, maybe if you've gone in and you've hacked whatever the Defense Department computer or brought down a financial institution's computer and, you know, wreaked havoc on the economy or on national security, yeah, sure, you know, penalize that. But, you know, this kind of stuff, this kind of behavior that people engage in every day to turn it into a felony is you know, I think a little dangerous.
The interesting thing about that is I see people equating it to, you know, like if you went out, what he's being charged with doing is equal to if he went out and, you know, sprayed graffiti on a wall. But the interesting thing there is, and correct me if I'm wrong, he's not even being charged with doing the actual defacing.
Right. It's a conspiracy charge, and they call, you know, conspiracy the prosecutor's friend. So, yeah, he's not being charged with actually having done it. He's being charged with, you know, entering into a conspiracy to do it. You know, in a conspiracy, you just have to have an agreement to whose object is illegal and one overt act in furtherance of that, you know, agreement to commit a criminal act. So that's a sign that, you know, maybe their case isn't as strong, but, you know, they're still, you know, it can be tough to beat.
I want to get to the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act specifically, but before we do that, just one last question about the Matthew Keyes, what's going on with Matthew Keyes. I noticed that a lot of different articles were pointing out that there was a tweet back from March of 2011 from the now notorious anonymous hacker turned FBI informant Sabu, who has been outed as Hector Xavier Monsignor. And did this outing stem from? I mean, did the charges stem from Sabu outing him online, or was this being looked into before?
You know, I don't know. It's so early in this case. I haven't, you know, had a chance to like get all the discovery. I don't know at this point. I mean, that's a good question. I just don't. I don't have a factual basis for answering it right now. Basically.
Okay. Great. Thank you. I just thought I would ask, being that I mean, it's interesting to me that all these hacking cases seem to be all these hacking prosecution cases have been prosecuting hackers have been coming from. Ever since Sabu has been turned this FBI informant after he was caught, I just find it to be incredible.
Oh yeah, I find it really interesting too, and believe me, it's something we'll be, you know, looking into.
So let's jump quickly to the CFAA specifically. Can you quickly and briefly just I guess give us an overview of what it is and how it's being used against? I mean, it was most famously used. In the late Aaron Swartz's case, he was facing, what was it, I think 35 years in prison under the CFAA for going into MIT closet, connecting his laptop to their network, and accessing like a mass amount of publicly accessible academic journals. And just amazing, 35 years for that. So what is this act, and what does it say, and how is it being used against these people?
Well, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act originated in roughly, I think it was 1984, and, you know, before the internet, before HTTP, you know, iPhones, iPads, you know, everything. And essentially it was designed to protect, you know, federally protected computers, you know, and I think major economic institutions. And then slowly, over time, gets amended, and it does a number of things. The main thing that you're seeing in most of these prosecutions, like Swartz and Arnheimer, is it forbids unauthorized access to a protected computer. Like I said before, a protected computer is just anything with a microchip. The problem with it is that it doesn't define anywhere what unauthorized access means. And so you've got the courts all over the country, you have different definitions of it. You know, some people are like, oh, just violating the terms of service of a, you know, a website means unauthorized access, which I think is an extremely dangerous interpretation, because everyone's really committing a felony, every day. But it's become like this tool of the DOJ because it's so malleable and I think so broad and vague for, you know, prosecuting anybody who essentially has done anything that they think is remotely wrong with the computer. And I think it needs to be amended. And there's EFS is working on that. A number of people are trying to get the statute under control.
It's funny how I've been reading some of what EFF has put out on it, and especially I mean today is the 7-year anniversary of Twitter being launched, and I found it interesting how they named off all these big names in tech and just innovation entrepreneurs who could have been and would have been probably tried under this act if they were doing this today. I mean, Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, Mark Zuckerberg, Twitter founder Jack Dorsey just recently was talking about how he got his start hacking. And again, hacking is not necessarily a bad term. You could hack for good, hack for bad. You could just hack any product. You could hack a product you own, like how you could hack an Xbox 360 you purchased to do something that maybe it was not originally meant to do in the operating system, but you have it, you know, playing files from your computer or something. It's just amazing to me how they're trying to just turn the term hacking into this amazingly negative term. I mean, the press and people in general always had this, I guess, negative connotation of hacking. But what we're seeing in just recent years is just this complete, like, just I can't even explain what they're doing with this. It's just they're just grabbing anybody who has any knowledge or savvy in computers and technology, and they're trying to just try them under this act, it seems like to me.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, I've said it before, I think hackers are the new communists for the DOJ. I think there's a lot of irrationality and fear out there because people don't understand, you know, what's going on in the computer world. You know, there's a big disconnect. All sorts of, I get contacted by computer security researchers and even people like you're doing data mining for the financial services industry freaking out about these prosecutions because they just consider it to be just normal, you know, computer behavior. And so, you know, there's this big disconnect from the people who don't understand anything about the computers, the computer world, who are actually writing these laws, and then the people who actually work, you know, in the computer world, who just, you know, think these prosecutions are insane.
we were joking in the office the other day about how, you know, we remembered there was a time when, you know, they would find a hacker like this, not like this at all, an actual hacker who actually, you know, found a flaw in a security system and broke in and was able to manage, access this, you know, back-end management system, and how they would find these people and they would, you know, use their savviness and their intelligence to, you know, they would cut a deal and use them. Like, what happened to something like that where they would, you know, cut a reasonable deal with these people, and where did they just fill up all their hacker job slots? I mean, I don't quite understand why they're going full force on these people now when they used to, you know, at the very least offer them some sort of reasonable deal.
Yeah, and I think that's what the Chinese are doing with their hackers. I mean, you know, they're
that's a great point.
All their hackers
that's
have really, really good government jobs, I think, over there. And I think, you know, what you see with a lot of these people, like you mentioned, Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, and, you know, all our, you know, Swartz, all the great computer innovators, they do this stuff because it's part of their process where they're learning, you know, about computers and systems and whatnot. And I think it's a very fundamental to their ability to innovate. And I think if these prosecutions had been around, you know, in the 70s, you wouldn't have Apple Computer, you wouldn't have Microsoft, and you would have had a chunk of our GDP wouldn't exist. So I think there's an economic harm in what's going on with these prosecutions that I think is bad for the country.
The weird thing about all this happening just now to me too is, and not so much weird, but just hypocritical again, just completely unbelievable that just the end of last year, the Supreme Court declined to review a lower court ruling in a case that challenged a Bush-era law, which is the FISA Amendments Act, which basically retroactively gave telecommunications firms like, you know, Verizon and AT&T, that they gave them legal immunity for performing warrantless wiretapping. I mean, how can you say that AT&T has the ability to just not respect their customers' privacy, but an individual can't publicly access information that AT&T is using, I mean, that AT&T has made available because they don't respect their customers' privacy?
Yeah, I know. I think that's a good question, you know, and I think that it's disturbing that they got that, grant of immunity for warrantless wiretapping on U.S. citizens. That's extremely disturbing.
I just really want to try to drive home the point here to listeners that, I mean, regardless of what you think about, you know, someone like a Weave or a Matthew Keys or their, you know, their internet histories or whatever, there's two things going on here I think that's important to drive home. Number one is that none of these cases are hacking cases. They're just not hackers. And that's what they're basically being tried for to the full extent of the law. And then number two is that these laws are so draconian that regardless of whether you think any hacker is guilty or not guilty in their case, the sentences they're being dealt do not fit the crimes that they're being accused of.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to I feel like those are the two important points here to drive home to people, because I see, you know, a lot of people talking about these two cases because they're the most recent, but just hackers in general, where, you know, oh, they deserve to be punished or whatnot. And I think it's important to you know, separate people who actually do hacking from people who just discover this, just like you or me could have discovered, like what Weave and his what his partner, I'm sorry, I forgot his name, did basically.
Daniel Spitler.
Yeah, any one of us could have come across that. It was just a public URL. And with Matthew Keyes' case, I mean, that's not a hacking case. And in terms of him, I'm seeing just so much, you know, and Weave too, just so much, you know, negativity to their character. And I mean, you could think what you want, but I think it's important to drive home that one, these aren't hacking cases, but that's what they're being perceived as. And number two, that whatever you think their punishment should be, what they're being charged with just does not fit the crimes. And I just want to thank you.
Yeah, I agree. And the one thing I would add to that is that these laws are so broad and vague that they potentially encompass, computer behavior criminalized computer behavior by thousands of Americans engage in every day. And the government historically always goes after the unpopular defendants first, you know. But people should be concerned about these prosecutions because the law is so broad and so vague, it invites arbitrary prosecution by the government.
I mean, it makes so much, I mean, especially in the Weave case to me, because, I mean, if you or I came across this information they came across, I mean, maybe we wouldn't have the savvy to pull the information like they did, but we, people should know about this, that AT&T and other companies that you're paying money to and your customers are just care so little about your personal information and your privacy that they're willing to save a buck to just leave this information out there. Tor Eklund, I just want to – I'm sorry, continue. You have something else to say?
Oh, no,
Tor, I just want to – Tor Eklund, I want to thank you so much for joining us. We'll be following the cases of where Weave's case goes from here and Matthew Keats' case, which is just beginning. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Take care. All right, folks. What time is it? Oh, it's time for the better half, isn't it? Should we do a? Should go to? Go up a little bit more.
How's that?
All right, I hear you.
I told you.
Wait, hold on. I don't hear you. Are you bringing up the empty one?
Yeah.
Bring it up a little bit louder.
It's as high as it can go.
Wow, I'll take a look at that when I'm over there. We're gonna switch now. So let's go to the better half. I have a story, but we could do that in the better half. You know what? Let me do it really quick. Sure, why not? All right, so I thought I'd do this story really quick. Politico has a story where basically they decided to look into the disconnect between the inside and outside the Beltway attitudes on gay marriage. And basically they decided to take a look at this thorny time, especially for Republicans, and go speak with Republicans. As you know that... Rob Portman last week became the first sitting GOP senator to endorse gay marriage, of course, after learning that his own son was gay, because apparently you cannot feel empathy for anyone unless this is happening to you if you're a Republican. Also, at the RNC, they had a bluntly worded report detailing the GOP's political woes, and because of this, they called for the party to become more sensitive on the issue of gay rights. More sensitive. Well, a new Washington poll has found that support for gay marriage is at a historic high. This should not be news to anyone who's paying attention to just what is going on outside your own door. 58% of Americans back the right to marry for gays and lesbians, compared to 36 who think it should be banned, which is a complete reversal from a decade ago. I believe it is, 9 states and the District of Columbia have legalized gay marriage. So Politico decided to go out there and find some Republicans to talk to and see if their thoughts on gay marriage has quite evolved. Maybe like President Obama's has evolved. And they spoke with, we got Senator Lindsey Graham. I'm with South Carolina. I believe in traditional marriage between a man and a woman. Without animosity. I don't mind if people are able to transfer their property, visit their loved ones in hospitals, but marriage to me, I've stayed with the concept of traditional marriage. That's coming from Lindsey Graham. We got John McCain, who Politico reached, and he said no when asked if he was moving away from opposing gay marriage, even though his wife Cindy and his daughter Megan have announced their support for it. A lot of the views on marriage varies with lots of different parts of the country, McCain said. On the issue of gay marriage, that is a moral issue in my view. It depends on your fundamental beliefs. But on an issue such as comprehensive immigration, it's an issue of whether going to, in my view, move forward with an issue that needs to be addressed. 11 million people who are out there living in the shadows. Does he not understand what he's saying? Really now? Really? Really? He's worried about 11 million people who are out there living in the shadows, talking about illegal immigration, the issue of illegal immigration, which I agree with McCain there. It's an important issue. But who else is living in the shadows? But finally, this to me was just amazing. Politico talked to Senator Saxby Chambliss when he was asked about his views on gay marriage and whether they have changed. The Georgian Republican replied, "I'm not gay, so I'm not going to marry one." What is he projecting here? He was asked what his views on gay marriage are, and he responds, "I'm not gay. Who's I'm not gay? What's going on? I'm not gay."
Even Lindsey Graham was better.
Even Lindsey Graham. Lindsey Graham. Dealt with that better. I mean, I'm not gay, so I'm not going to marry one. What would happen if his son was gay? Would he still tell his son that? I mean, what is going on here? That they can't even, I mean, how is that even a response to that question? I'm not gay. Who, just unbelievable. Unbelievable. All right, folks, that is the first half of our program. We will now go into the better half of the show. You can call us at 646-257-3920. That line is open to the regular listeners of the show. If you're a libertarian or a conservative, feel free to call the libertarian or conservative line, which is 646-257-3920. You can support this show by becoming a member at majority.fm. Without your support, folks, this show would not be possible. Sam has a new child. We are running on two people when he's not here, just me and Michael. And we're not even sure if Michael's mic is up right now. Michael is amazing on the mic, but when it comes to sitting behind the soundboard, we could use some other people to help out here.
Several other people,
yes. So your support can possibly help us do this when Sam's not around. And when Sam is around, too. You can also support this show by following us on Twitter at MajorityFM. You can subscribe to us on YouTube at youtube.com/SamCedar. You can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/MajorityReport. You can donate your account at donateyouraccount.com. If you have previously donated your Facebook account, recheck to make sure it was still donated. Facebook recently changed something with their donation permissions, and you might have to re-donate your account. You might notice that our stories have been showing up on your feed. Become a member. Stick around for the better half. I'm going to switch up with Michael Brooks here. Again, my name is Matt Binder. I am joined by Michael Brooks, and we are filling in for Sam Cedar. Let's hit the music. Oh, and we have some great stories for you, too. Stick around. Great stories coming up.
Say to Napu, hey.